here with Soleil Ho. She is a writer and person who works in restaurants in New Orleans. She writes about food gentrification, food issues, and the intersections of race, class, and gender, with all of those topics. So thanks so much for coming to W2L News and Views.
Thank you for inviting me out to this beautiful dog park.
Yeah, we're here in the French Quarter. And yeah, I just wanted to invite you on because I saw your article about food gentrification. I thought it was an interesting take on, you know, we've been having this sort of quote-unquote tailgate issue going on in New Orleans, and sort of seeing it all from the perspective of people being pushed out of their food cultures, or at least white culture sort of appropriating.
I thought it was really interesting how kale is used as a marker of cosmopolitanness in New Orleans, and I think a lot of that association has to do with Whole Foods, and a lot of the rhetoric that surrounds the fetishization of ingredients like kale, and you know, I wrote that article also about collards,
right?
And Whole Foods' new push to make collards, quoting the new kale,
right?
So what's going to happen in regions like New Orleans, where collards are sort of a backbone ingredient for the communities here?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when collards actually gain that superfood status and become a mark of cosmopolitanness? What are they going to eat? So
right.
All these questions have been really interesting to me, because I used to be like a pretty problematic foodie, you know, in my youth. I guess I'm still young, but when I was really, really young, I thought, like, ingredients were the most important thing. And I think you see a lot of this in, like, American culture at large. And I thought, like, oh, yeah, truffles, oh, my God, caviar. Like, let's get this from, like, Argentina, because that's the best thing. You know, like, without thinking about impact and thinking about just what it means to strip the food of its context and really just take it for itself, rather than thinking about the people that have to deal with it.
Can you talk about those kinds of effects? Like, what comes to your mind, or what changed your mind about it?
Well, I think my gateway to sort of consciousness was the issue of quinoa, which, you know, I think many of us are familiar with. It's sort of a mixed bag in terms of the actual consequences, because Bolivia has actually been really proactive in dealing with that fallout that people were concerned with earlier. So it's sort of a recap, I guess, for your listeners. Quinoa is a really trendy grain, right? It's a whole grain. It's got all your amino acids. You know, people love that because, you know, it's nutritious and it's trendy and it has a funny name. And, you know, you can get quinoa flakes for breakfast and quinoa flour if you're like a celiac or just going gluten-free. Anyway, then people realized... there were stories coming out of Bolivia and those regions that grow quinoa that basically said there's so much demand globally for this grain that the people there who were growing it could not buy it for themselves. And the result was malnutrition and just, like, malnourishment. People were not able to eat this ancestral food that they've been eating for centuries because, you know, we were buying it up in Brooklyn. And I hate to say the B word there, because everyone blames Brooklyn for everything, but you know what I mean. Like, all these communities, all these gentrified communities were really interested in this exotic grain for all of its beautiful superfood effects. So that's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So, like, that there's actually economic impacts on the places where these foods are created in terms of pricing out the people who make it.
Right. And I think that's part of this machinery of capitalism, too, right? Because it's the alienation of the worker from their product. And in a lot of ways, foodie culture is complicit in that. It's alienating, because all you want to think about is the food. You don't want to think about the person who grew it, the person who harvested it, the people whose hands have touched it before it arrived at your table. Unless it's the chef, you know, a celebrity chef, and that's a totally different thing. But, yeah, that's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So could you talk more about, like, your transition from foodie to, like, how would you describe yourself now, or how do you relate to food?
I think right after college I decided to go work on a farm for a season just to see what that was like, because I felt like I was so ignorant. because I, you know, I was a food blogger and I was just like, whatever, like food is so good by itself. Food is like the greatest thing ever. But I didn't know how much work went into it. And so I went to work on this farm. I like, you know, grew vegetables from seed and all these things, watched like animals get slaughtered. And then I realized that at other places, you know, at hippie places, it might be like my experience, but by and large, like that also coincided with like the Michael Pollan thing. Bless him, but you know, there are many other voices that are important in talking about these issues. And so more and more people were becoming conscious about food insecurity and agricultural policies and things like that. They were making things really difficult for farmers. And so while I was out working on a farm, I would talk to neighboring farmers about like why they were growing like fields of soybeans or fields of like just corn that no one can eat. And they had some really serious reasons for that. Like they were trying to make sense of like all of these nonsensical policies that we have that reward just farmers for growing stuff that no one eats.
So what is happening with the products instead of people eating them?
Well, they, they're harvested, and a lot of it just becomes ethanol in the Midwest, which is, you know, ethanol. but there's this tracts, like huge tracts of land out in the Midwest that could be growing food, but they aren't. You know, a lot of the corn is going to animals, you know, like feeding herds of cattle, pigs, sheep. And so much of that food goes into them for so little output. And that's, it just doesn't make any sense.
Going back to Bolivia a little bit, what were some of the policies that, that the Bolivian government put in place to help mitigate what was happening with the quinoa staple?
Well, they did some price freezes, which is good, and they've started serving it at the schools, the public schools, for lunch for the kids, so that there would be some guaranteed route. Like, no matter how much it cost, they'd be able to get some at least like once a day at school.
How might I know that there's a lot of food truck kind of energy happening. How might that be fueling food gentrification?
Oh my goodness. Well, so before I lived in New Orleans, I lived in Minneapolis. And in the years that I was there, like 2009 to 2012, they were experiencing a food truck surge. Like, it was coming up. It was coming so fast. The legislation had just come out where it relaxed kind of the restrictions placed on them. And so it was this huge boom. And the funny thing that happened there was that there are already food trucks that are operating under the radar, you know, taco trucks and all these. I think it was mainly Latino-owned establishments that had these trucks. And so once it became legit, they got pushed out because the real estate that they were using wasn't as available, and people were on the lookout more. The funny thing is foodies were looking for these trucks, and they started documenting where the trucks were. And so if you were trying to be under the radar, that was problematic. And so it had that effect. And I find that here as well. There's a lot of homegrown trucks, right, that sell like yaca mean and soul food and just tacos. Taqueria Los Poblanos is a favorite of mine. But I think there's definitely a stark divide, right, between the slick food trucks with, you know, beautiful graphic design on the side and, like, you know, nice young college graduates selling organic tortas and such. And then you have the folks who are actually just really, I don't know, I think graphically it's really interesting, too. Just what appeals to the, like, the gentrifying gaze beyond what doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I think as more and more, like, as this, like, food truck explosion, this energy builds up, I think you're going to see a lot fewer of the more homegrown trucks. because people are going to be looking for a certain image, and I think as that image monopolizes the scene.
It's just funny because, like, food gentrification is a strong term. It, like, there's something that bothers me about, like, the way that everybody is trying to go out to eat all the time, but I don't know, like, what it is exactly, or, like, what would be the ideal state, I guess, is sort of the question, like, if this is not the way we want to be interacting with people eating who are healthy.
The main issue, and the main issue that I've always, I mean, I had these, like, basically this, like, three-part series on that magazine whose name we can't say.
Mm-hmm.
The first essay, called Craving the Other, is a more personal essay about Vietnamese food and about, like, foodie culture. And then the next two are more about explicitly about food gentrification, which is a concept that kind of came out after, thanks to Mickey Kendall, this really amazing Twitter person, tweets at Carnithia. But the seed of this whole thing is this notion, which I think is a very Protestant notion, it's a very, like, American notion, where what you buy makes you a good or bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And what you display consciously makes you a good or bad person.
Hmm.
You know, and I think that's why being a foodie or whatever has kind of fit so nicely with social media, with Instagram, with just sort of pictorial, visual communication culture that we've established in the past few years.
Right.
So, you know, when people are making really great red beans and rice, they probably weren't taking pictures and posting them online. They're feeding their families. They're feeding their friends, their communities. I think that's the difference that has, you know, emerged just in our culture at large and in, you know, in a small part in New Orleans as a microcosm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also think that the thing about food gentrification and how it feeds gentrification.
Right. Yeah.
But then also thinking about where maybe it differs a little bit, and so I'm sitting here listening to you, and I started thinking about how there's that globalized aspect of it, because we can affect food prices in Bolivia,
yes,
because of our demand, just like our demand for drugs, the ways in which that affects the living conditions in other countries. So there are these. So that kind of made me think about, like, that aspect of it and how it's more into, there are more international implications, I think, of this form of gentrification, which it also, but it still does the same thing of removing kind of historically owned and operated culture. With gentrification, it's land and access to resources. And this is, you know, it's similar, but it's, you can have effects that you don't even, that you can be oblivious to being a gentrifier in a regular way, but you can be really oblivious to being a food gentrifier.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if there's a question in there, but that's what I was sitting here stewing over.
Well, I think what they share is the idea of reframing, you know, changing the frame of reference of something. Mm-hmm. You change the frame of reference of a neighborhood, mm-hmm, right, you transform it, and with food, it's the same thing. You change the frame of reference for pho, right? You put it in, you know, Lower Garden District instead of, you know, in New Orleans East. You kind of change where it's at, and then everything changes. The idea of going out to eat pho changes because it becomes more of, I don't know, like a yuppie thing, a gentrified thing. Rather than you're in the community where it's normal, right? It's not, mm-hmm, like you're going on safari to a restaurant and trying something exotic and new.
Right.
So with this phenomenon, it's like folks are wanting to participate in this culture without really participating in, without really having a relationship or understanding.
Right.
And folks want to sell it, want to appropriate it, so then they can sell it, and then they don't have to even show the relationship. Like, no, you can sell quinoa, just like that example. You can sell quinoa and not ever talk about Bolivia or talk about South America, talk about the indigenous folks that used it as a staple. Or you could use that as a selling point.
Mm-hmm.
This is the superfood of the Incas and all,
yeah,
that kind of stuff that they do, like with cacao and those other things.
That's exactly what you were saying about how food gentrification relates to gentrification, too. That's the same mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same impulse. You know, you can move into the Treme and not talk to any of your neighbors. And you just wait for the yoga studios to come in, right? It's the same principle.
Yeah. So how do we share our culture through food without it being, without it becoming gentrified? How do we do it without it just becoming another commodity, which then can, which once something becomes commodified, it's easily removed from the folks that cultivated it and cared for, nourished and maintained and sustained and built culture and history around these points, around these.
Yeah, and it's especially episodes. Interesting, or it's like, because food, especially, I guess, I feel like in New Orleans culture, it's like a given. Like, yeah, you have it outside of your house and you're giving it away to people. Like, it's like made to be shared and like appropriated in that sense. Like, we right. want people to come eat our food and tell us how great it is because we think it's so great and special.
Right.
So it's like, where is that balance? So I'm still wondering, like, what is the ideal state of people interacting with this stuff? It's still, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of my work at this point has been just focused on pointing out the issue, right? So I haven't thought too much about solutions. But since I've gotten so much feedback about my work, I've been thinking about it. And it seems like the core of that is the idea of equal exchange. Because you were talking about like giving it away freely, like sharing freely. Mm-hmm. And I think when it happens on a flat hierarchy, it's fine. You know, when people are giving and receiving equally. And I think for the most part, that doesn't happen. I think on the neighbor level, it happens, of course, and that's awesome. And we have so much of that in New Orleans, and I love it. But, you know, when we talk about global issues, globalization, it's not on an equal level. I mean, farmers within the U.S. are not getting compensated on an equal level for what they give. And so we need to think about that. We need to think about just allocation of just like, where is this money going? And thinking about how to level that playing field, because as it stands, there's so, it's just so weighed in a single direction, mm-hmm. that I don't think we can say that we're sharing equally with the purveyors of like the spices that we're getting from like Asia, with just the vendors, like the seafood folks who work in Louisiana are not getting what they deserve. For all the rhetoric that surrounds the seafood in this region, they don't get half as much as what they deserve.
Right.
And, I mean, considering, like, what happened after that oil spill, like, God. And so many of those people are Vietnamese American, too, and so it's just like, what do you do? What do you do with this? But to go back to that original point is just, ideally, it would just be sharing between equal partners. And not going into like a new like foreign restaurant and just taking the picture, not talking to anyone, and squirreling it away and just never coming back. You know what I mean? Like I think for me everything just comes down to community. Are you fostering a community? Are you partaking in this community? Are you giving anything to this community? And I think I see a lot of that in mid-city where I live, in the Treme, where people go out of their way not to frequent black-owned businesses, for instance. Like, for some reason, like, it just doesn't register to them that, like, being part of a community means going to places in the community and supporting the people in the community, and enabling people to be equal partners in your relationship to that community.
One thing that I did want to talk about, too, since we have you on and we're talking about food gentrification, is food prices. Mm. Food prices are really high here. Yes. I actually went to Baton Rouge just to go to Trader Joe's, and, you know, an hour and some change, you can find food a bit more reasonably priced. It's almost like we live on an island here. It's almost like we have island prices, you know, somewhere when I was living in Hawaii. Why do you think the food prices here are the way that they are? Do you have any kind of insight on that?
Well, I've noticed that, I've heard from people, too, that so many grocery stores didn't come back after the storm, right? And I think that enables people to gouge prices because there's only so many, like in the Bywater, for instance, there's only the Co-op and Mardi Gras zone, and it's really hard to find groceries that are not incredibly expensive there just because no one wants to go to the Ninth Ward. No one wants to set up shop. I mean, Robert's is going to be there, which is great, but I don't know what their prices are going to be. I think that's what has to play. And, gosh, what's his name? That actor.
Brad Pitt.
Wendell Pierce.
Wendell Pierce. I think he's doing great work trying to level that playing field, level the prices by opening up his, I think, Sinclair Farms or something. Opening up these grocery stores in places like Algiers that just don't have, like, a nice locally owned place at reasonable prices. And so I think we need more people like that to just step in and be like, let's... I mean, you know, like, for all the crap I talk about capitalism, like, I think the healthiest part of it is competition. Without competition, you can have insane prices. There's no impetus to, like...
Well, I think that's a little bit false. I don't think that you need competition to have fair prices. Mm. I think that's a value. Like, people understanding that because they don't have the value of, like, I'm providing this service for this community.
Right.
It's more like, I'm providing the service so that I can get profit.
Right, yes.
So I think that is a part of that competition in capitalism. So I just want to challenge that a little bit.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, but that's legit.
Because people try to make it seem like this hyper-competitive is just naturally a part of us and who we are as a species, and don't act like there were thousands of years of building that into the culture to make it look the way it is does today.
I think after the storm, it seems like there's been a culture fostered where exploitation is the norm, right? In terms of grocery stores, at least, like, because that is just... That's what I mean, I guess. There's no one stepping in. Well, until, I think, people like Wendell Pierce, there was no one stepping in to say, like, hey, we should think about community. I want to challenge this culture that is just not thinking about that at all. And, you know, people like the Rouse's company, like, they pay a lot of lip service.
Well, let's also, I don't want to invisibilize a lot of people that are doing work around food justice, too. You know, like, Jenga Mwendo, who does the Gorilla Gardens in the Ninth Ward, and then there have been people like Pam Broom, who did Wanda Women and Agriculture, and a lot of other people that I'm not going to be able to remember or mention right now, but I have looked a little bit into food justice in New Orleans, something that I'm interested in. So there definitely are people, plenty of black folks in the city that are thinking about it and trying to do something, and trying to remind folks that everybody used to have a garden, that, you know, that there was all that kind of sharing of food, and people were responsible in some way for cultivating that.
There's so many great nonprofits here that are doing incredible work, too. And just, I think Nola Green Roots and Holly Grove Farms and all of those folks just blows me away. And honestly, I think the farther away from, like, the grocery store model we get, the better it'd be. Just so that it's in people's own hands. There's all this stuff I'm talking about, like the rhetoric of kale and collards, like, it wouldn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I don't want it to matter. We should be asking, like, do you guys get stuff? Like, you know, you should ask, like, the proprietor of your local, like, po' boy place, like, where do you guys get your stuff? Like, I think it'd be really cool, like... I know this farmer, like, I know this person who grows vegetables, like, I can hook you up, you know? We need to start building those connections, too.
Mm-hmm.
Including everyone in this conversation.
Yeah. It's interesting. It really is. It's such a, like, this is what you're saying about it being, like, a visual tag, and, like, it is such a, like, badge of your culture, your status, like, where you eat, like, what kinds of things you eat, what you don't eat, you know? And on the other hand, everybody eats. And it's like this great equalizer and such a way of bringing people together, like having meals together. So it would be cool to see it used more in that way. I mean, I think most restaurants in New Orleans are incredibly segregated. It's one of the main places where you see that.
It made me think of the that Dr. Seuss book where those creatures drew the stars on their bellies. The ones had the stars, and they were the ones that were upper class, and they found a way to get the lower class found a way to get the stars painted.
Yeah.
So it's almost like that. It's that it's that delineation of class.
Totally.
Like, I'm able to, you know, afford these. I'm able to afford to eat vegan, organic, gluten free. You know, and not just because I have to, but because, you know, that's my choice.
Right.
So it definitely is.
Or
is
like,
I'm
gonna drop $120 on like some appetizers. Because you can do that here now, which is like shocking.
Yeah.
But, like, I think that's the reason you do it. Like, is the food that much better? No, you know. It's just something you can spend the money on to feel like you did that.
Oh, my God, yeah. The whole choice philosophy of our current economy is just astounding. And you think about choice feminism, too. It dovetails really nicely with that. where that, you know, you are your choices. You've chosen to be vegan or not vegan. And you don't think about the class aspect of that. Like, does it make sense to be vegan if the cheapest thing you can get in your neighborhood is roast beef? You know, like, it's a lot more complicated than that. But choice makes things so simple. And I think it helps people, too. Like, think of themselves as moral beings because I've chosen this. Mm-hmm. And I've made that moral choice. And so I've saved myself, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right, the politics of choice and the invisibilization of desperation. And what were these choices are really the context behind the choices that people have to make, and even the access to information that some folks don't have.
If you think about time too, right? If you have like one or two working parents who might not have time to cook at home, is there a choice between going out and cooking? Like, is that a real choice? I don't think so, because, you know, it's easier to go to McDonald's. It's just faster. I've been there, like, when I was growing up. Like, we would order in McDonald's all the time because my mom had no time at all. And cooking was a luxury. That was something we did on the weekend. So, yeah, it's just really...
And we can bring that back to capitalism.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And the ways in which inflation has risen and wages have not.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I did some research for my last article about that, about wage stagnation. I was astounded because I thought it was bad, but I didn't know it was that bad. But it's like publicly available information. You can find it on the web. And the ways in which it fluctuates according to, you know, your gender or your race is just really interesting as well.
I noticed that it was like Latino women had the lowest.
Yeah. The cost of buying groceries, of buying food, has increased by 18%. And
since when?
Since 2007. From 2007 to 2012, those are the numbers that I was able to find across the board. And that's from USDA. That's what they're telling us.
Hmm.
And when you think about inflation, right, it would make sense, it would be okay if wages kept pace, but it's not. Any argument about inflation makes no sense if wages are not being inflated at that same rate. It sucks all around.
Right. And then we have this argument that's happening around minimum wage, and it's, which still wouldn't raise it high enough.
Right.
It still wouldn't raise it to be a real living wage in this country.
It's ridiculous, too, because when the minimum wage first, you know, was introduced... it was meant to be the bare minimum for which someone could support a family. That was what they were entitled to. And the rhetoric has become so warped ever since, gosh, I want to say like Ronald Reagan, he ruined everything. Ever since the silent majority, ever since all of that, like, really, really strong anti-entitlements rhetoric, took force in the 80s. It just seems like people get angry at you if you have minimum wage, if you make minimum wage. Like, you're getting what you deserve for being blank. Fill in the adjective. It's changed so much. I mean, the attitude around that. So it's no surprise it's so hard for it to, it's just so hard to get that to change from what it's been. It's been so static.
Anything else you want to add?
Basically, all I wanted to say was eating X, Y, or Z does not make you a good person, and I will say that to my grave. It does not make you a better person. You're just eating food. You're going to poop it out later. I guarantee it.
I do have one more thing, though, to maybe ask.
Sure.
is the implications, we kind of touched on a little bit, but the implications of consumer responsibility. Because we can be, it's in this country, the ways in which we consume, I like the idea of maybe talking to the places where you frequent and, you know, seeing where they're getting their materials. But then we'd have to apply that same out to everything that we buy. Like, I really think that we should.
Yeah.
To be informed consumers. That would be very difficult because we're running in this rat race and we're all so busy, busy, busy that we can't take time to really think about the implications of our actions and consumption. Mm-hmm. We just kind of do it because that's
how capitalism works.
Exactly.
We get you.
So have you thought about ways, besides just asking, of how we can be stronger, more informed, more questioning, more avid about fairness in our consumption?
That is a question that I've thought about a lot. Because, like, I think our generation, you know, I don't want to make assumptions. I don't know how old you guys are, but at least my generation, you know, people who grew up in the 90s grew up from an early age thinking recycling was going to change the world, right? You know, maybe it has already. We don't know. We think that, like, CFLs are going to change the world. It's very easy to fall into the trap of, like, what you buy is going to, like, going to make everything better, that you're voting with your dollars. And I think that idea is so flawed and so screwed up. Because in the end, you're still participating in this economy. You're right. Still buying into all these extremely unjust ideas and corporations, you know, and so on and so on. So consumer responsibility, to me, is a flawed concept. As long as you remain in that relation, the consumer relation, you're not being responsible. You need to be proactive, and you need to create. You need to produce.
But, yeah. I mean, I would go back, though, to what you were saying of the bottom line being community on some level, because I think there is a way of consuming within the confines of your community, or like, and activating and like using your role as a consumer to build those connections,
yeah,
and be in like in relationship in that level.
I think as a consumer, if you, in terms of responsibility, if you take the responsibility of not alienating products from their labor, if you take the responsibility of thinking, like you were saying, like being more conscious, just being more critical. About what you buy. That's a good first step, but it's not going to solve everything. Just, I think as a culture, we need to reframe our relationships to the things we've bought, the things we're wearing, the things we're eating, the places we're going. Because when you think about the rhetoric of like artisanal food, for instance, you know, like handmade jelly or handmade mustard or whatever, you're forgetting that everything's handmade, but it's like, whose hands are making them, and whose hands are more important to you in acknowledging.
Right. And I do like your point of, like, you're not a good person, because what it brings up for me is, like, it's not, it shouldn't be a badge of, like, a symbol of your privilege or a symbol of your status. Like, you, be, I mean, that's how advertising works, I guess, but just, like, if you can take back your consumption of food as yours, because it is your body and it makes you who you are, what you eat on that like tangible level, you know, it's a fulfilling process.
Yeah, if you keep doing things in order, I mean, you know, if you're eating to be noticed, you gotta think about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Reconsider that whole operation.
Sure.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
I really enjoyed it.
That's fun.
All right, that was Saleh Ho speaking to us about food gentrification and all other things wrapped around that.
All in the kitchen sink.